Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good.
Doing okay? How could you be doing poorly, really, on a day like today? How many people were here yesterday? So a lot of you were here. Great. How many? So let me see hands who were not. Some new folks. Great. Yeah. Seemed like there was the same number of hands. What just happened? Yeah. Anyway, so yesterday we sort of talked a little bit about the origins and sort of the why of people go on pilgrimages. But we're going to do a little bit more specifically with something called the Pilgrim's Creed today, and we're going to get at that by way of a biblical story in just a minute, to sort of ask the questions about what is the difference. We'll have this question in a minute about what the difference between like a pilgrimage and a trip and these sort of things, and why is it that we should care about these things. But before we go anywhere, right, I always think it's important for us to breathe together, which you remember means that's what the word conspiracy means, is when people breathe together, they are forming a conspiracy. So what I want us to do is just take a moment, and this meditation comes from when I was in Plum Village with Thich Nhat Hanh in France for a while, and this is one of the ones that they teach there. It's just so very simple. And Thich Nhat Hanh has a very specific rule. Well, it's not a rule. It's a suggestion for when you meditate. That is to say, make sure you're comfortable. I find, make sure your back's kind of straight. But he says, do this. Smile. When you meditate, smile. We get very serious about contemplation. But if you smile, what happens is all these muscles and nerves are triggering to your brain that things are okay, right? So as you breathe in, and we'll just do this for a few moments, say to yourself, present moment, and as you exhale, say, wonderful moment. Let us breathe, inhale, present moment. And exhale, wonderful moment. Please continue. Thank you. It was a psychologist named Fred Luskin who one time I heard him, he gave a series of lectures, and he's a secular guy, and he said he found it so strange that in religious settings that we would just launch into anything without having a moment of meditation. He said that's such a, because he with his classes always does that, just says, because we have to make the transition oftentimes from getting here to being here. And I know for myself, there's always my mind is lagging behind someplace, right? My body is here, but my head is still in what I was doing before, and it just takes a moment to do that. But thank you for doing that for me and with me. So what are the differences between a pilgrimage, a tour, an adventure, a vacation? What are we talking about when we're talking about a pilgrimage specifically? Any ideas? Throw out what you think. If you've been, especially those of you who came yesterday, if you've been thinking about it a bit, what do you see as the differences?
Intention.
What's that?
Intention.
Intention, absolutely, yes. In fact, I would go so far as to say, like with a pilgrimage, there is a sacred question that you're carrying. But here's the thing, you might not know what the sacred question is. It's okay to go on the pilgrimage and not even know what the question is, and to let the question arise. But you're seeking it, and you're seeking... And so that means that a pilgrimage can also... It's far more interior than it is exterior, as that goes. When you think of it, by the way, none of these things are bad things. They're all good things. But I think that we want to make some distinction. And I just thought about that because as I was having a conversation with my girlfriend yesterday, we were talking about the fact that yesterday some of the things were beginning to overlap a bit. And it might make some sense to have some distinction. Like you can have an adventure, and that's great, but it may not necessarily be a pilgrimage. There is a sacred element to the pilgrimage. There's something that's going on where we're letting God sort of catch us and do something new with us, have God's very way with us in a way. Vincent Donovan wrote this book, Christianity Rediscovered, and I love the image when he talked about in Africa how he always was trying to portray that we are like lion hunters and we're seeking after the lion until finally he had the realization that no, actually God is a lion, but we're the ones being hunted. And it changes the relationship. And that when God comes up and catches you, and sometimes you can put yourself in places where it's easier, maybe, for God to get a hold of us. And some of that's more of an internal thing that you're doing than an external thing. Today we're going to talk about what's the difference between a tourist and a traveler, right? I love this quote here by Mark Twain. He says, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and women and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." I was just doing the podcast with Jonah, and I was talking about the fact that one of the ways I think that pilgrimages does fit the theme of unity and love here is that there's something about travel and encounter with other cultures and other specific people that shatters our bigotry, shatters our illusions of that are misconceptions that we might be carrying with us. I've seen it happen. As I said yesterday, I've led 9 different pilgrimages, and I've seen it happen time and time again where people are carrying an idea to a culture or to a religious group or a sort of ethnic group that they're going to come see. And they can be even positive things. They're not necessarily even negative stereotypes, but they're stereotypes. And I do this myself. And then you get to the place and you meet the people and you have this experience and you can't not think of that every single time that you run across this people group in other places, right? I've seen this especially true with the interactions between Christians and Muslims. We have so much baggage in our culture about what we think Islam is about. And it's only by having these encounters with these folks that you then have, you just can't walk away thinking that you understood anything. So here, I'm going to do a practice with you all. This is an important practice. Take your hands, right, and tap your shoulders 6 times. We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay? We're going to do it again, and we're going to put in the words. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Repeat after me. I don't know everything. I don't know everything. Look to the person next to you and do it. I don't know everything. Excellent. You just did a confession, right? And it's an important confession. We don't know what we don't know until we get confronted with something that's different. That's kind of what we're looking for. All right, we're going to take a look at a Bible story. It's Jacob's wrestling. This is an art piece. I forget the name of the author. It was at a contemplative retreat that someone brought this art piece out, and I just fell in love with it. And it's their depiction of this moment in Scripture. But I want to sort of get us there. We'll come around to it again. You'll have a chance to take a look at it again. But let's sort of catch up on the story of Jacob. By the way, if you are not a person who knows Bible, that's okay. We're going to work through this together. So this story is kind of it's definitely an archetypal story. It's one of the essential stories for the understanding of the Torah. Jacob is born. He's a twin. His brother is born first. His brother's name is Esau, which means red, because he had like red hair. But not only that, but he was, as the story is going to go on, he's the firstborn in that culture, was the birthright, the one who was going to inherit everything, and he was kind of a man's man. He loved hunting, he liked making meat stews, this was his thing, right? Jacob is born second, and he gets, his name means the heel grabber, right? The one that trips people up. It would be probably close to the word scoundrel, right? A con man. He's a con man. That's who he is. So think con man. Red and con man. And you might say, what's in a name? Well, oftentimes we live into our names because we think that they chart our destiny in a way that maybe has more power than they should. I am a father of twins, and I will tell you that Rachel, who was born 19 minutes before Naomi, lords it over her all the time. She always wants to be known as the older sister and the more wise sister, even though it's 19 minutes. It's a thing, I'm telling you. So Jacob, the con man, the heel grabber, he's a mama's boy. He's his mother Rebecca's favorite. He watches Cooking Channel with her. They work in the kitchen together all the time. And she is always trying to get something good for him. So they come up with some schemes. The first one he does all on his own. Esau is out hunting. He comes back. He's been skunked. There's nothing that's happened. He's hungry. In fact, he's so hungry he's famished. And when he walks in, Jacob is making this wonderful lentil soup. And he says, give me a bowl of that soup. And then Jacob says, well, I'm going to give you the soup, but you have to give me your birthright. You have to give me what would happen for you as the firstborn. And he's so hungry that he gives it to him. He says, yeah, okay, whatever, I just need that soup. Think about that for a second, especially what we know about the arc of Scripture. Is it ever okay to use hunger as a reason to get something from somebody? I mean, it's just the total opposite of what we see as especially also in those cultures at that time. If someone is in need, you welcome them in and you feed them. In this case, his own brother, you got the soup right there, but give me your birthright. He knew he had leverage, and so he used it. So he cons his brother, and then later he cons his father out of the blessing that he was going to give to the firstborn. This is mom's idea, by the way. Rebecca comes up with this plan, says, you know, your brother's got hairy arms and you got those little skinny smooth arms and he has this deep voice, so I need you to practice the voice. We're going to put lamb's wool on your arm, right? And he can't see very well. He's an old guy. He's on his way out. He wants to give his blessing. So walk in there and say, hey, Dad, it's me, Esau. And right away, by the way, Isaac knew. He said, that doesn't sound like my son. And he says, yeah, well, feel my arm. Aha, yeah, that's my son, big hairy guy. And so then he gives him his blessing, and then Esau comes and says, I'm here for my blessing. And Isaac says, too late, it's already gone. Apparently you can't give two, right? Says, it's too late, you're already gone. He's conned his brother out of the birthright, and he's conned his dad out of the blessing. And now Esau, he's had enough, he's going to kill him. So time to take off. He hits the road, gets out, and he goes to Uncle Laban. And this is, to me, just such delicious storytelling irony. There's nothing worse than when a con man runs into a con man, right? I mean, a BS artist hits a BS artist in this case. And so he gets there, and he falls in love with Rachel. She's beautiful. And so he asks Laban, can I have your daughter as my wife? He says, absolutely, no problem. We're going to make that happen. You just got to work for me for 7 years, and at the end of that, I'm going to give you my daughter as your wife. Perfect. He works hard. 7 years later, wedding night, and there's no kids here, so I can tell the PG-13 rated. The way it worked in that culture was you consummated the marriage that night. That was when you were officially married. You had the ceremonious thing, and then you go into the wedding tent, and the couple would make love, and now they're officially married. And so, but there's a party in between those two. Right? There's sort of a bunch of dancing and drinking and hanging out. And in that time, Laban got Jacob pretty drunk. And then when it comes time to consummate the marriage, he slips in his daughter Leah instead of Rachel into the tent. So he consummates the marriage with the other sister who, I don't know what the deal is, but it says that there was something wrong with her eye in Scripture. So I don't know whether she had a lazy eye or something, but she probably was, anyway, not as attractive to a suitor. So he's now married Leah, and he's all up in arms, but Laban cuts him a deal and says, actually, I'll give you both of them, and you can marry, we'll continue the wedding party, you can marry Rachel right now, but you got to do another 7 years. Right? So he cons him into 14 years, marries off both daughters. They're very successful in their work, but then you can't have two con men around each other for too long. Eventually, they've grown tired of each other. It's time to hit the road. And so he takes off and he cons Laban out of more of his share. So he does this trick about the spotted goats and everything. And he gets more than is his share. And he says, let's get out of here. He takes off with all of his children, all of his goods, his two wives, and off they go. And now they're going right towards where Esau is, and he knows Esau's looking for him. This is now 14 years later. And he's thinking, so here's his plan. Still a con man. There's a river. I'm going to put all my stuff and my family on that side, on Esau's side of the river. So, I mean, why do you think that's a good plan?
Right? They're going to protect him.
Exactly. Maybe if he takes all my stuff, and maybe if he, you know, hacks up my kids a bit, he'll be tired of that, feel like he has his vengeance, and I'll be safe. This is not a good guy. Not yet. Right? In fact, he hasn't done what we would consider an act of real integrity yet in this story. So now we're ready for this story. That's the background. So could we have somebody read that story for us?
The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man, B, said, "You shall be..."
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God, and with humans, and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel. Peniel?
Peniel, yeah.
Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God's face to face, and yet my life is preserved."
Okay. $64,000 question. With whom did Jacob wrestle? Was that?
God.
Well,
it says so there at the end.
He thinks
it says that at the end, but what does it say at the beginning? Who's he wrestling with at the beginning?
A man.
A nameless man. Does the man ever claim to be God? But Jacob's pretty sure that he's wrestled with God, right? What's the issue about the name, right? It's like he's carried this identity, and the identity has shaped his actions, his whole life story. I've been con man. I've been con man my whole life. I've conned my way through my family of origin. I conned my way through my relationship with my uncle and with my family, my wives. He also has a whole nother story with other folks in this. But the bottom line is, he continues to con his way through, and now he's going to get a new name, which is the one who's wrestled with God. That's what Israel means. So this is a huge turning point for him, and it turns right here. The guy, he says, He strikes him on the hip socket and puts it out of joint. I don't know if you ever had your hip out of joint. I never have, but it sounds pretty painful. And in the midst of that, he says, let me go. He says, I will not let you go until you bless me. This is, I think, a huge archetypal story for us all. What do we do with pain? Right? I think every healthy spirituality is trying to help us answer this question. What do you do with your pain? And the answer from this story is that you let it transform you because you hold on to it until it blesses you. If you are at all involved with the Enneagram, then you'll know what I'm about to say. If you are not, then please don't worry about it. You will not be saved by knowing the Enneagram. I'm a 7 on the Enneagram, which means our motto is no pain, no pain. Right? So we've never seen a party we don't love. I would prefer my life to be pain-free. And so when pain comes into my life, I try and do everything I can to get pain out of my life. But that's never, ever blessed me. I have learned at great cost at times that when I can hold on and say, this pain is my pain, what does it have to teach me? Then the blessing can come and it can transform me. And I think that that's true for all of us. And that's certainly true in this story. And so, I guess one of the things that I want to say before we get right into the Pilgrim's Creed is this whole thing is about wrestling with our ego. That's what a pilgrimage is also an opportunity to do. We even the whole act of it, we set these lofty goals. I'm going to walk 500 miles. And most people who put that goal out there, or I'm going to go do this incredible, this trek, ride a bike across country, or I'm going to, whatever it is that is your pilgrimage goal. And then there's this moment about, day 3, right? Where people say, this is the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. And every person who finishes their pilgrimage always says, you have to decide, I'm not going to focus on the end, that I'm going to finish it, I'm going to focus on today. I'm going to focus on, at least I'll do it today. I can't promise tomorrow, but I'm going to do it again today. And then you do the same thing the next day. And that is it's an assault on our ego, which is good. Father Richard Rohr says that one of the best ways to translate when Paul's talking about that there's this dichotomy between flesh and spirit, he says it's way better to translate flesh as ego. Because that makes sense, right? That we really understand that the ego has its own desires and they almost always go contrary to the will of God's Spirit. Whereas if we can just get ourselves out of the way. If I was going to make a bumper sticker, it would be, your ego is the enemy of your happiness. Because that's the thing we're always trying to protect at our own peril. So this wrestling is in some ways we're inviting God to wrestle with us on a pilgrimage. How do we do that? Well, here's the Pilgrim's Creed. It's 5 things. And this is from from people who walk the Camino de Santiago de Compostela. Number 1, and talk about how this wrestles with your ego, right? I am not in control. I am not in a hurry. I greet others in peace. I walk in faith and hope. And I bring back only what God gives me. I'll leave that up there. We'll come around to it at the end, so if you don't get them all down, you'll see them again. This picture on the side is Clonmacnoise in Ireland. It's an old cloister of a monastery where all the roofs are gone. It's from back in the 11th century. And it's a beautiful space. It used to be a thriving area with lots of, because the two rivers come by there, but now it's just open fields and these old Gothic windows and towers. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And there's a little puddle of water that gathers in this one graveyard area that is said to be able to cure warts. So people I was with put their wart-infested toes and fingers in there and I don't know whatever happened to that, but just so you know. All right, so let's talk about some of these. I am not in control. How do you feel about taking the hands off the steering wheel of your life? What comes up when you think about, can we have some self-confessed control freaks tell us their story in the crowd? Anyone here a control freak? Yeah? Thank you. Yeah. I think at some level we all struggle with this. Right? So, was that?
I go into panic mode when anybody that I'm riding with, they take their hands off the wheel.
Yeah, yeah. You want to know something that's fascinating to me? Is like this is a Tesla, by the way. It's an advertisement for Tesla where they have their new thing where it'll drive for you if you want to let it drive for you. We are really close within 10 years from having self-driving cars be the majority of the cars on the road. Let me give you some quick stats. Human beings driving a car have an accident every 160,000 miles on average, right? When you take all the people who drive. And then right now, at the level that self-driving cars are now, they average an accident every 500 to 600,000 miles. Now here's the thing, they're gonna get better. We are not. So there will come a time in which people will look back at us now and say, did you live in the time in which you would listen to the radio about the traffic report and you hear where all the accidents were so you could try and avoid it? That's crazy. Why would you be okay with traffic accidents? In the future, there will be cars that don't have accidents, except super rarely, super rarely. But yet, whenever you bring up the idea to most of us and you say, hey, ready for a self-driving Uber? Because they have them in Pittsburgh, by the way. Are you ready to get in one of those? The answer is, oh, no. Oh, no. Have you been in an Uber with people who are doing all sorts of other things, distracted driving? But do you see how we have this thing about control, right? I want to have control. I want two human hands on the steering wheel, especially mine. It'd be great if there were my human hands on the steering wheel. But here's the deal. This is where I think some of our Buddhist friends give us a lot of help. Control is an illusion. We have no idea how out of control we really are. And we surround ourselves with a story of control that is not real. Anyone who has had the rug pulled out from under them in their life knows this to be true. And if you have not had the rug pulled out from you in your life, blessed are you, but your turn is coming. It's kind of how it works. The question is, what are you going to do when it happens? And if you lament your loss of control, that seems silly, because you're lamenting something that you never really had. So when you walk in your pilgrimage, when you go on this, you get up every day, and one of the things you say is, I am not in control. Whatever happens today, happens. So, when you think of letting go of control, I want to ask you this question. If you think about it, if you just like close your eyes and think about like letting go of some area of control, think about it like maybe it's in your work life, or your love life, your professional life, if you think about letting go, what do you feel and where do you feel it in your body? What do you sense?
Relief.
And where? Where does it feel?
From heart and head.
From heart and head. Oh, that's interesting. Very good. Thanks. Others? You guys are all good with relief and heart and head? Yeah.
No, I always feel it in my gut.
In your gut?
Yeah.
Yeah. And does it feel good or bad?
Oh, no.
Not good. Yeah, not good. Yeah. The tightness?
Oh, yeah. That's
yeah. Bad. Yeah. Almost sometimes people say like a queasiness that starts to come over. Any others? Yeah. Right here. Does it feel tight or does it feel expansive?
Yeah.
Tight?
Yeah. Yeah. Can't breathe, can't talk.
Yeah.
I say I feel relief and then immediate panic.
Relief and then panic.
Yeah. Interesting. It feels good to let go of it.
Yeah. Do you remember the bumper sticker a long time ago? Is that God is my co-pilot? Okay. Remember that one? I always thought That's a silly bumper sticker. Why would, I mean, switch seats. If God's your co-pilot, it's like, you think you're a better pilot than God? Yeah, it makes no sense. Anyway, I think that this is a huge one for us in our culture about control. And it's, anyway, that's what Jesus was asked what to pray for, and he said, he was very immediate. And it is a release of control. Give us today our daily bread. Thy will be done, not my will be done. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's an exercise in sort of saying, here you go. This day is yours, and I'm not gonna pray for God. Help me accomplish all my things today. That's a different level of trying to control. All right. So the second one, another cultural challenge for us. I am not in a hurry. Yeah. Where does this one strike you? Do you feel, I mean, by the way, you're up at Holden, so it's the easiest place to not be in a hurry, okay. Except for you two. There's a few of us, yeah. There's a few, you two. The folks who are like, you know, on staff that are like, sometimes they have to hurry all the time. But for the rest of us, this feels like the most expansive. At least it does for me. I love the Holden time that you refer to. I wonder why it just is a Holden time thing. It's you know, I'm in Southern California, so it's down to the minute sometimes, right? You know, we live in a world where doctors are encouraged to bill in 15-minute increments, right? So I have appointments in 15-minute increments. So you've got 15 minutes to solve your problem, to describe, diagnose, and solve your problem. We all know this, right? This is a huge issue. But imagine if you're walking and you're trying to get a long distance, and one of the things you say every day is, I'm not in a hurry. Try this, by the way, in an airport. If you have time. Obviously, right? I mean, but here's the thing. Here's what I do. I often have time, and I still act like I'm in a hurry. That's just crazy. But if you can catch yourself, there's two things I recommend for airports. One is, try and see if you can help other people go first on things and watch what they do. That's amazing. And the other is, another Thich Nhat Hanh suggestion, is you do walking meditation and you look at people and just walk aimlessly through the airport and look at people and just give them a look of love. Right? That's it. Just try and catch their eyes and just see them for a second. And he said, you go around, you're walking around, you're just blessing people by just looking at them and seeing them. And it fills you up with this incredible, great sense that this is a community that it can become a community if people become more mindful and intentional at the moment. And airports are the best to do it at, in my experience, because people are so ramped up in their hurry and control and device and everything else. I see now more and more whole lines of people get into a plane, and not one person is talking to one other person. Everyone is talking through their device. And I just wonder what that's going to do to us. We have this thing called the tyranny of the urgent, right? The thing that's, and if I can bubble up my thing to become more urgent on you, but the urgent is not the most important. And that, I think, slowing down it helps us to see that. So, I'm not in control. I'm not in a hurry. And then I greet others in peace. This is a Hawaiian greeting of peace. You find it in some other indigenous Pacific Island and also Alaskan cultures where you greet this way, where you touch nose and forehead, and you take a full breath together and you breathe each other's air. That this is how you connect with each other. It's an intimate form of greeting each other. In Hindu cultures and also in yoga studios everywhere, you hear namaste. I always think this is a great way to share the peace. If you think about what you're saying, this is what it means. I honor the place in you which the entire universe dwells. I honor the place in you which is of love, truth, and light, and of peace. When you are in that place, and But when you are in that place in you, and I am in that place in me, we are one. Great way to be able to honor each other. Here, fun fact. Anyone know why we share the peace just before the offering in the liturgy? Anybody know? Well, it's because Jesus said to. He says that when you have something that is broken between you and your brother or sister, do not bring your gift to the altar, but instead go back and make peace with your brother or sister, and then bring your gift to the altar. Right? And he wasn't talking about Christian worship, he's talking about temple stuff, but the bottom line is, what we're supposed to be doing at that point is reconciling. It's right at that turn where we've had the gospel preached, and we've sung our response, and we've prayed, and now what we're supposed to do, instead of turning around in our seats and saying, hey, how you doing, good morning, nice thing to say, but that's not the point. The point is you're supposed to go to the person that you have wronged and say, I know I wronged you, and I'm sorry, peace. And to have them return to you, peace. Think about how that would shift then, before then we go to the table. That's why it's there too. So that then we collect all the gifts, including the bread and the wine, and we come to the table. Because now we're ready to sit together. Anyway, just think about that next time you're sharing the peace. And maybe take a risk and see if there's someone you need to go and ask for a new chance with. Next one, I walk in faith and hope. My questions, real quickly, what is faith and what is hope? Let's start with what is faith. How would you define faith?
Trust.
Trust. That is what the word means, right? In the Greek word pistis is trust. Try every time you read faith in the scriptures, just change the word to trust and see how that changes a lot of our texts. How is faith different than belief? What would you say?
Knowledge.
Knowledge? Say more about that. What do you think? Like the knowledge is belief? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a closer thing. The word belief has changed a time. It started as from an English word that was by life, that you could see what someone, their values and what they were about by their life, right? But that became belief. But we have changed belief, I think, to our opinions. What do you believe? Usually means what do you think about? And we can have different beliefs. And I think that faith is an important distinction because it is, as you say, sir, trust, right? It's about, and the best analogy I can think of to give is, I can believe that planes fly. I have an opinion that they are often safe. Faith is getting in one, right? And you feel the difference, right? The first is, I can just have opinions. I can have opinions about God all day. And as one Episcopal priest that I know says, your opinions about God may be the least interesting thing about you spiritually. Right? Instead, my life will show what my faith is by my trust. Where do I have skin in the game? Where am I going to actually join in with my whole self? That's when I walk with faith. I am trusting God completely. And it's not just my ideas. And then hope. What do you say about hope? When you think of that word, is that a... Any definitions come up for you?
You believe in the unseen?
To believe in the unseen, to trust in the unseen, yeah. Well, I mean, Scripture does say exactly that, right? Hope. We hope for what we do not see or have yet, right? That's if you already see it, then you don't have to hope for it. But that idea of and here's, I want to say that hope is also different than wishful thinking. We have to, hope is different than magical thinking. Hope is usually based in a relationship, So you have this trust relationship that we're supposed to have with the divine, that the divine is going to come through for us in whatever specific ways, not magical ways, but instead trustworthy ways, and that hope is what doesn't disappoint for us. So we walk in faith and we walk in hope. This next one is, I bring back only what God gives me. Here's a Gaelic blessing for you. Someone on this side, please read this one for us.
Deep peace of the running wave to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the shining star to you.
How much do these things cost you? Right? These are these gifts that are just part of our birthright of being on this beautiful planet, is that we get these things given to us. When we go on trips, we oftentimes want to bring back a souvenir, right? Souvenir comes from Middle French, and it means the act of remembering. So we want to remember this event. We want to have something from it. And so there are, and this is every place I've ever been has a gift shop you have to go through that has plenty of things to help you remember, with the mug and the t-shirt and the all that stuff. But when you go on a pilgrimage, the whole idea is you bring back only what God gives you. So that's a different thing, right? What is it that God might give you? And sometimes they can be physical things that you find or that you are given along the way. And those can be super precious. But oftentimes they're not. They're instead memories. They're images. And that's why it's important to journal and to be paying attention to the changes. Because ultimately, if you come back with the same stuff in your backpack that you left with, that's a win. That can be a good thing. But it's because if everything that has changed is in here, easy to bring back, right? Thoughts about, do we have any people who are willing to also admit that they are souvenir folk? Yeah, me too. Right? You always want to have the remembrance, especially if it's some unique event, you want to make sure that you get something to remember it. That's totally, I think if it's connected to a meaningful event, it's really connects with the idea of what a good souvenir is. I also, father of twins, I had to bring back something from every trip, anything that I did for them without fail or else trouble ensued. So there it is, the Pilgrim's Creed. I'm not in control. I'm not in a hurry. I greet others in peace. I walk in faith and hope. I bring back only what God gives me. Pilgrims are instructed to say this to themselves in the morning, to remind themselves of this as they walk along. Some actually then will make like a patch. They'll write something and they'll put it on their pack. Some people will make sure that they're bringing it up. It's their screensaver on their phone, so whenever they're checking where they're going or calling somebody, they can just see this thing come up. It's a constant reminder. This is how I'm going to walk this path. This is how I'm going to do this limited experience, however long it is. And the idea is so that it maybe shapes my longer experience. So maybe this becomes a new pattern, a new habit. It is said that for something to become a habit for you, it takes 30 to 40 days. So that seems to coincide with Lent. So if you also wanted to take a season like Lent, and you don't even have to go anywhere to practice this, some ritual around this. Wake up in the morning, brush your teeth, have this on the mirror, read it out loud, and remind yourself that this is how I'm going to live this day. I'm going to not be in control, not be in a hurry, greet others in peace, walk in faith and hope, and only take back home what God gives me. Reactions, thoughts, questions, protests. What do you got?
Where does it come from?
Comes from other pilgrims. It's been developed over years by people who walk the Camino, and I don't think it has a specific origin.
But it's specific to the Camino.
It's specific to the Camino. But I think it works really well for lots of lots of different pilgrimage opportunities. Yes?
I guess I'm just reflecting on the countercultural piece, obviously, of this and the beauty of that, and how that would, that practice then feels like something difficult to bring to my work life, especially the first two.
Yeah. Did you hear what she said? That this is a very countercultural creed, and that it, while it's beautiful, it might be very hard to bring back to your work life. Right? Is that what you said?
Well, I just had this image of telling my boss these first two things, and I'm not.
What do you do?
I work in a hospital. I'm a physical therapist.
Physical therapist, right. Yeah, so you're exactly in a control and hurry culture.
Well, I need to be in control for my patient's safety,
right.
And I have productivity expectations.
Sure.
That keep me
sure.
Awesome.
And I would say maybe this is meant more metaphysically about control, right? I mean, while you as a physical therapist need to control a lot of variables, you have no control about what's going to happen ultimately, right? You know? Yeah. Yes?
My predisposition for, I hear you talk, is that the pilgrimage is most often taken by people that are either retired or in between careers, or I've just said, I'm giving up on all of that. I'm just going to do this.
Well, my daughter Naomi is right now on the Appalachian Trail. She's an emergency room nurse, and she has a profession that she can step away from and step back in. You have a lot of people who are exactly like you say, between jobs, or they're, and sometimes people just get to a place where they realize, I can't do this, whatever the this is, anymore, and they don't know what's next. And that usually is a great opportunity. Oftentimes it is retired people who can do this as well. But it's sort of one of the things we were talking about yesterday, and we'll get into a little bit more tomorrow. We can come up with 1,000 ideas not to do something like this. There's always going to be a reason, even if you have the right type of job or you're retired. By the way, the busiest people I know are retired, right? So you can always find a reason, but I think that some of the nature of this thing is just you have to go. Like, in some people, it's like you have to go now.
Well, just in the religion of Islam, it's one of the pillars to do the Hajj.
Exactly.
To Mecca, and the word Islam itself means to surrender.
Right.
So
right.
It's like this very, yeah. It's, you know, so for us Christians, it's, you know, it's a good reminder, and it's good to be open to that. It's another way.
Thank you for bringing that up. We had talked about that last time with the Hajj. It's one of the five pillars, and it's very valuable. When I was in Madagascar, there were some villages that couldn't afford to have people all go, but they would all have these festivals and raise money to send one. And they would, and that was a very honored position. And they were going on behalf of all the other people. And so they had responsibility to share all that with folks when they came back, because they understood it's such a central part of that religion. It used to be a bit more in ours. That's where the Camino de Santiago de Compostela comes from. Was the idea of making a pilgrimage to some place where there was a relic, and we tend to. Especially Protestants tend to gloss over some of the deeper meanings of it. We tend to think of it as like, well, they thought that if you went to the relic, then your sins would be forgiven by the saint. So we say, yeah, that's silliness. Is it? I mean, because the whole process of the walking and all of the doing it is a way of psychosocially and spiritually cleansing yourself, right? It's... And I say this as a Lutheran pastor, so you can turn me into my bishop if you like. But I think that grace is incredibly wonderful and is a gift to us. But the way in which we apply the grace in our lives is oftentimes too easy. Right? I mean, we could learn from our Jewish brothers and sisters on this one. For example, Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the new year. And that's the day where you're supposed to do a fearless inventory of who have I wronged in the last year. And then 10 days later is Yom Kippur, which is the day of atonement with God. And the idea is, in those 10 days, you were supposed to fix it up with whoever you've wronged. You were supposed to have gone first to the person you wronged and then come together to Yom Kippur, to God. I think sometimes because of our focus on God's grace and forgiveness, which is central, but we do it in a way that's like, if I know God forgives, and so I confess to God, I'm forgiven, and it's over. But the circuit's not complete in terms of our community. And so there is something about accountability, and sometimes I think making a, I need to do something that is going to cleanse this. And it's not because God needs it. That's I think, the Lutheran addition theologically, to say God doesn't need that, but you might. Right? I mean, we might need that push. That makes sense? Yeah. I don't know, as soon as you start talking this way, Lutherans get weird. It's like, it's works righteousness. It's like, no. You're forgiven if you do it or not. You just might not feel it. You might not have an experience of it. Right? It may take a little more, depending on what it is. Right? Maybe it's going to take getting your hip out of joint. Right? Maybe that's what it's going to be before you're going to feel the blessing that you need. Other pieces there? No? Good? I'm going to play a song for us. Actually, let's do this first. Let's end this way today. Let's say together the Pilgrim's Creed, and then I'll start the song, and that'll be how we'll end, okay? And together we say, I am not in control. I am not in a hurry. I greet others in peace. I walk in faith and hope. I bring back only what God gives me.
Any truth in your light, and now my heart stumbles on things I don't know. My weakness I feel I must finally show. Lend me your hand and we'll conquer them all, but lend me your heart and I'll just let you fall. Lend me your eyes, I can change what you see. But your soul you must keep totally free. Heart, 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 heart. Heart away, my soul. Heart. Thank you.
Thank you. Our third class will be on Thursday at 4:00. Thank you.